Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How would you survive if some kind of global catastrophe rendered traditional status symbols irrelevant? If money and coolness suddenly meant nothing at all, while courage, creativity, and persistence were the only things that allowed you to thrive? Is it possible the whole social order of 21st century America would turn upside down? A new play called Barbecue Apocalypse opens with three couples keenly aware of status. Homeowners Mike and Deb are hosting a barbecue for four friends and fretting over the state of their fixer-upper house and uninspired fashion sense. When, at the end of Act One, everything changes, all three couples are in for some big surprises that yield not only a lot of laughs, but also some keen insights into the ways contemporary American culture leads people to assess their own worth. Matt Lyle is the playwright who wrote Barbecue Apocalypse. Lee Troll is director of the production. It runs May 23rd through June 21st at Kitchen Dog Theater in Dallas. Guys, welcome to Think.
Hey.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
So congratulations, first of all, on like pulling off a very funny comedy that also has the destruction of the civilized world thrown in there. How did you develop the idea, Matt, for something with apocalypse that would also be very funny?
I've always liked apocalyptic literature, like Ridley Walker and The Road. Those are all really dark, and I can only kind of write comedy. So my only way to do the apocalypse was to take a light comedic touch and look at the apocalypse. I had the idea watching The Walking Dead. I had basically the first act of the play, which is this comedy of manners with these very self-aware people with all these first world problems, and I had no idea how to end it. And while watching The Walking Dead, I went, I have a second act! There's a point to all this. So,
and were you worried at all that people wouldn't come along with you once you... I mean, there are jokes.
Yes. Always very worried. Yeah. Go ahead. Continue. Sorry to...
Well, I mean, there are people who can laugh, and no matter how ridiculous it gets, they know what you're doing, and then there are other people who are going to say, well, that's not funny.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always a worry. I always, if you kill 99.9% of humanity by the second half of a comedy, there is a worry that perhaps it's going to be a different play in the second act. And in some ways it does kind of work that way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still funny. I feel like we've kept the same comic edge from the first act, but everyone's dead except for these few people.
Yeah, and to be fair, we don't know yet if people are going to laugh.
I laughed.
Oh, good, good. Well, there's one.
So tell us about these three couples. We have Mike and Deb and Ash and Lulu and Wynn and Glory. What kind of people are they?
Well, they're three very different couples, but recognizable. I think Mike and Deb are very, very normal people in their 30s, aren't sure yet if they want to have kids, aren't sure yet what their life is about. You know, Mike wants to be a writer, but isn't quite making any headway there. Who knows what Deb does, but it's probably something corporate. And, you know, and they live in a house that if there weren't other people, they would be very happy with their house. Mm-hmm. They'd be happy with their living situation. But they have these two friends, Ash and Lulu, who are foodies, who are what Matt describes as yupsters, which I think is people with money who get to dress like people who don't have money.
To use their money ironically.
Right.
That's
and then there's also Mike's sort of childhood friend Wynn, which is a great name, and his very young girlfriend Glory. And I think Wynn is one of those great friendships that I think a lot of men have. I don't know. I feel like I have some female friends that just get rid of these friends eventually.
That's probably the smart way to go.
Yeah, but I think I have friends in my life, and none of them are listening right now, that I think, wow, if I met you today, I don't know that we'd hit it off, or that I even necessarily think that we have the same politics or the same ideas. But you've been around. We've had some crazy times. So
shared experience has created a relationship that wouldn't have been there if you met as adults.
It's not the best grouping for a barbecue to go successfully.
No, it's not set up to succeed.
It's not relaxed. A barbecue should be relaxed. Mm-hmm. People should be comfortable with each other. And no, that's not what's happening. And that's how we create drama and comedy.
Yeah.
Well, the Wynn character is great. And it also almost made me think about a sibling relationship where you've got that. And my
big brother.
Sisters are both great. But there are siblings who will, into adulthood, really kind of tear each other down. Mm-hmm. And the one who is the aggressor will say, I'm just kidding around. Come on.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, but it cuts to the core.
Yeah.
Yeah. The pushing of the buttons. Yeah. Wynn is my favorite character because he's the least likable. Mm-hmm. which I found it really easy to write a really unlikable character, oddly enough.
What's interesting about him, though, is the word that I want to use to describe him I cannot say on the radio, so
okay.
People can imagine what that
just
is.
Just describe it, like, generically.
No, I think that would still be problematic, actually, if I'm thinking of what the word is.
We'll leave it to our audience to visualize. But anyway, but he's also still, like, you don't exactly root for him, but you mm-hmm. can't, you don't absolutely hate him, even though he's a terrible person.
Yeah, I think he doesn't know who, just like the rest of the characters, like Mike and Deb, who are the ones hosting, that are the ones that are most self-conscious about their status among the group. You know, they don't dress right. They don't own the right things. They don't know anything about all this stuff that their friends know about. Wynn is in the same way. He has found that he thinks he can define himself with his money and how he looks in the mirror after, you know, really blasting his pecs, and he thinks that's who he is, mm-hmm. and that doesn't make for a whole person. Or how he feels, he thinks he feels great when he is putting down the lesser characters.
Right.
You know, that is great, and he thinks, oh well, this is okay. But he, and what I think, what I enjoy about the second act, where all of that stuff is totally taken away, all the money, all the status symbols, it really affects him the most because he was maybe even the most blind in the first act, thinking that all of that was what defined him, was how big he was and how much money he had in the bank.
I thought the casting was really spot on, and I'm curious, Lee, you can, I don't know how many people came in to read for you. You can have lots of people who are great actors, who are funny actors, but chemistry really matters when you have a cast this small.
I think it's essential. We have a company of actors at Kitchen Dog Theater, and actually I'm a part of that company myself, so I know we have 7 actors in the show, and 5 out of the 7 are our company members, and the other two, one is one of Matt's oldest friends, and the other one is a good friend of mine who went to SMU, which is the school that a lot of the actors went to. So that first of all, I know them well. I understand, you know, when notes get a little heated, you know, mm-hmm. or our conversations get a little strange, or the weird, the sort of weird stuff comes out.
Notes are when you're at the end of a rehearsal.
When I tell them all the bad things they did, and you know, and I can tell where, you know, where some of the frustration might be coming from, and also they just really trust each other. We have them doing some very, like, you know, awkward things. The funny thing about acting is you're kissing a stranger often, you know, or you're like. Or you can see in plays where people are sort of like half touching each other, you mm-hmm. know, like sort of, kind of, you know, we're kind of hugging. And I think something about that, the audience can tell that that's not honest. And this cast has no issue with just falling all over on top of each other. We did hold auditions. Some of the roles were pre-cast from the actors that I knew. And then the Glory character, the young woman, we did audition a lot of young, attractive women with the lead actor, Mike Federico, in the room reading. And that was very stressful for him. He just felt like an old guy, you know. He's just like, oh, that's just you're all doing great, you know. but for me, I usually have an idea of who I want. And I think that auditions are brutal. And I think they can be really unfair, especially if you already have an idea of, like, I think I know how to make this work.
Mm-hmm. You're just waiting for someone to walk in that seems to fulfill your vision.
Yeah. Well, sometimes if it's a small enough community, it's a company of actors I know, I just hire them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's remove as many as much awkwardness from that process as possible. You're the one I want.
So you're both actors in addition to the other things that you do. And I would imagine that both of you have on more than one occasion had to fake chemistry, right? So how do you, how do you do that?
Lee, do you know how to fake chemistry? Because I don't know that I've ever successfully. I'm not a good enough actor to.
I think there's some things you have to shut off. You know, you have to what we would call drop in, and that often has to do with eye contact. and really doing the thing that you're doing,
yeah.
If you're pretending to kiss someone, then the two real people have an issue. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But if you just go right in, you know, and just go for it, then, you know, and I don't know. I've had chemistry with people on stage that I truly can't stand off stage.
Mm-hmm. I like everyone.
Yeah.
That's my problem.
Well, I brought the list of names of people I don't like. I didn't know if there was some. Is there an
error? That's for segment two.
Okay. Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah.
But, and it's not only sexual chemistry, we should say, because I think, you know, in any relationship, there are people that you meet and you instantly hit it off and you can't really say why. And it may have nothing to do with mm-hmm. being attracted to the other person in any kind of romantic way.
Well, but that often doesn't actually turn into onstage chemistry.
Really?
Yeah. There are times where I'll see people that are just so, like, chummy backstage and sometimes what it removes is a sense of danger between mm. the two people, a sense of mm. We're working this out in front of each other. You know, we're
having something at stake,
right? And also through the rehearsal process, developing trust. Yeah. You know, there's got to be those moments where you're like, I cannot stand that person, and then choosing to support them, choosing to go into battle. This is such a terrible. I mean, I hate it when I hear people describe something as like going to battle, but in a way, you think this is what part of the sort of boot camp of rehearsals is to go, okay, at the end of this process, I got your back and you've got mine. And I trust that. I don't have to trust that in real life, mm-hmm. but I have to trust it on stage. And I think that part of that is the director's job to really put that together.
Matt, it must be peculiar to write something and have in your mind pictures of individuals. And no matter how great the actors are, no matter how perfect they are for the roles, they're not creatures that have sprung from your brain. So how does that feel?
Odd, first of all. So you are exactly right. I have a little movie. I've been living with the play from its almost 2 years now, from the first idea to the first draft to all of the development stuff we've done in between. So I've been with it a long time. And so I've got a little movie in my head and translating it, adding all of these different moving parts outside of it that I have no control. Do I have no control over any of it?
You have a little bit.
A little bit control. I have a little bit of control over it.
The fact that you're sitting here and that you're, you know, in the
yeah,
same
I can
city
say whatever I want to. Yeah, it is a strange feeling, and I am at this point a little just caught up in the ride mm-hmm. with it. But it is also surprising, man. Like last night I watched a run-through. I came in and rehearsed the first week with everybody, and I did a lot of rewrites and stuff like that. And I've been in good contact with Lee between. But last night was the first time I've really seen it with them off book and with lights and costumes and stuff. And the things I laughed so hard at all the stuff that I had nothing to do with. You know what I mean? Like all the jokes and all the stuff that I wrote, I was like, huh, yeah, that's a funny bit. They did that, right? And then the things that they as a group came up with, the little surprising moments, just really tickled me, because if it were just the little movie in my head, it wouldn't be as rich as it is when you add in everybody that collaborates and puts their two cents in.
Well, give us an example of one of those things.
Great. It's business between lines. Mm-hmm. There's a great moment where the Deb, who is one of the hosts, mm-hmm. that is the one who is most freaked out by her friends and judging her, you know, or it's really her judging herself. But she starts the show with a kerchief around her neck, and she's trying to affect style. And she can't quite get it done. And then the friend who she's most worried about, while they're having their first real conversation, is just on top of my lines. She's taking the kerchief that she had put around her head and tying it around her wrist to make it just right. You know, I would have never thought of that in a million years. And it was the best part of the play. Thanks, Lee.
We're speaking with playwright Matt Lyle and director Lee Trawl. Barbecue Apocalypse opens May 23rd and runs through June 21st at Kitchen Dog Theater in Dallas. If you want to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Boot Camp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with playwright Matt Lyle and director Lee Troll. Both of them have collaborated on Barbecue Apocalypse, Matt Lyle's play that opens May 23rd and runs through June 21st at Kitchen Dog Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. This show is also a great excuse to talk about timing, which we who are not actors or directors, we know it's essential. For us, it's a little bit like, you know, the definition of pornography or whatever. You know it when you see it. But I wonder if you both have a working definition of what timing actually is.
I think that rhythm is a big part of that. And I think that there's a score to a play. And I think it's true of both comedy and drama. It's just different sounds. I personally am a little obsessive about that. I want to make sure the actors are playing the music before that they know the notes before we start playing jazz. And then there's a real problem after that, which is they're only doing the timing. And you come back in once it's in their body and you start saying, okay, let's make this more human. Let's mean this. Let's really connect to this. And what happens is you have that little rhythm underneath. It's like a little metronome that's sort of running along. But then we're leaving out a big part of timing when it comes to comedy, which is an audience. What I've been telling them could be all lies starting tonight, really. Mm-hmm. And the audience will teach them more of that. And sometimes the audience will teach them the wrong lesson, which, you know, I have to sort of let go of, you know, that there will be times where it's like, well, if I just, they laughed a bunch when I paused here, what if I paused even more? And the truth is they may laugh more, but that doesn't mean that that's good necessarily, especially if we're at a story point where the thing that happens next is really important information. Mm-hmm. And if the audience is sort of like kind of done for a little bit,
right?
You know, because they had this
You've distracted them with another laugh.
Right. And it also makes it seem like that moment was the most important moment of that 10 pages, when maybe it was just the funniest moment of that 10 pages. You know, there's an odd sort of chemistry with an audience that as an actor, I was always very aware of and enjoyed setting up for other people. That part of timing is being the straight man, I think, is a really important part of that. And for me, it was always a really fun part of acting, because you it's like you share. Mm-hmm. It's like I think about being a point guard or something like that in basketball, where it's like I got the assist. Mm-hmm. And only the experts know that I was as big a part of, like, you know, right. of that right. slam dunk as the other person. You know, that's, you know.
You're willing to sacrifice the glory so that the whole thing works better.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's sometimes how you end up becoming a director out of that, because
you're finding the whole picture.
Yeah, and you're finding you're having more pleasure in being a part of it than being the star of it or whatever. Yeah.
There's a really an unteachable thing with comic timing too. I don't want to say either you have it or you don't, but I think some people are just really great at it, and I don't know where they learn to be that, to drop that line just right and just the right timing. Because as a writer, he said the music thing, comparing it to that. And it really is. There's a rhythm throughout. And I work really hard on that. And then it all kind of falls apart when people actually start saying it. But and then you have to build it back up. And that's what the director does. But just the individual actor, there's some people that the director can't help you get that timing just right because the actor just doesn't have it. And then there are some people that make everything work because they understand how to – just the right way to say a line, just the right pause, where the pause should be. It's really innate, and it's really hard to direct into people.
Well, it's
difficult.
It's a great pleasure, too, to watch when somebody's really good at it. I mean, honestly, it's like I can't speak a foreign language, and I'm not very good at math. And it's really fun to watch people that are innately good at something get better and better at it. Mm-hmm. And there are some actors that they just feel it, and it becomes better than what you directed or better than what, you know. I don't know what it is. It is actually, mm-hmm. Unteachable.
Mm-hmm. It's a gift.
So when you're writing timing into a script and you have that rhythm in your head, are you sort of overwriting that timing to make it work even for people who might not be absolutely gifted at it? Or are you assuming that you've got the best performers in the world that are going to take on this project?
I assume that I have the best performers in the world, but I give them as many clues as possible, like with punctuation, the difference between a period and an exclamation point or an ellipses or a comma. All of that is really important when you're looking at a script, and I really pay really close attention to it when I'm writing it, because I do when I'm acting as well. And writing in beats, a beat is a short pause, and you know, a pause is a little longer, a long pause. You know, I'm pretty specific about that. I'm not always right. Especially the way scenes just turn out a little different than you ever think they were going to be. But I'm really specific about it. But I'm open to whichever way that it works.
I think punctuation is the big clue. And the one piece of punctuation they left out is a question mark, which often is the straight man's job.
Oh, yeah, those.
You can hear, you know, and a good Shakespeare actor would make sure to ask a real question. And how you ask a real question is you go up an inflection. Well, you know this because you interview on air. But, you know,
asks questions real life.
Yes, that's true. Have you ever asked questions outside of radio?
I have never asked a question. I'm so certain of my life outside radio.
Just declarations.
But actually, what's interesting about that is that it's a trick, not a trick, but in interviewing, sometimes it works really well to set someone up for a good answer mm-hmm. by making a statement and letting them either agree or disagree with mm-hmm. it rather than going at it directly as a question.
You've just done that.
That was an example of using
very, very meta.
And I agree with you.
Well, I mean, I wonder if that's the kind of thing that you're thinking about mm-hmm. when you're putting, an interaction together between characters.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe a crutch a little bit, but I have always been good at. I'll say one thing that I'm good at is writing. Setup, punchline. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always looking ahead. I'll be looking three pages ahead at the way, like once I come up with what a joke or what a laugh in a moment is, I'm thinking about everything setting that up.
Where does
up
it start to ramp up?
Where does it happen? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it could be just the line before it, or it could be earlier in the act. We need to mention it a couple of times to really get that laugh. So I'm always thinking about how the other, what everything everybody else says will affect the other.
And I guess
actors.
You have to vary how long those ramps are so that some happen really quickly and some play out over a longer amount of time, or else it's too choppy, right?
Yes.
Otherwise, it's a whole play
vaudeville.
Vaudeville
is just set up punchline, set up punchline. Right. And I can do that, but it's not a very interesting play. I mean, you can use it as a little spice within it, so it's kind of fun. And we do that in this show. There's some real classic setup punchline, but there's a lot of character-developed jokes that pay off later.
How does it differ when you're directing, Lee, a work like this that is contemporary, where everybody is speaking like the people that you probably already associate with, the language is familiar, as compared with something that you have to dig to even help the actors make the words sound like they came out of the mouths of a real person? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Or like when we do Christmas Carol, mm-hmm. Charles Dickens at times can be difficult. Some of that is, some of when Matt and I say, oh, it can't be taught. Well, it can be taught. Sometimes the comic timing, one thing I was thinking is, I bet Matt and I watched all the same types of movies and TV shows mm-hmm. when we were growing up.
Yeah.
You know, I look in the script and I say Dick Van Dyke Show, or I say, you know, like, some old Jimmy Stewart stuff. I can just hear it.
You're really young for Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I think syndication really helped with all of that.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the nerd aspect of it. Just like, you know, I think if there's like a kid that's, you know, studies basketball and is watching basketball and plays it every day, I mean, like they'll be talking about basketball players that were, you know, two generations before them.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of that. So when we get into things like Shakespeare and Charles Dickens, especially like Charles Dickens or Jane Austen or something like that, some people just innately are attracted to that kind of language. I think that it can be as hard to do contemporary language as it is to do Jane Austen or Charles Dickens, especially if it's like written in a way, if it's written within an inch of its life with punctuation and all that, mm-hmm. you know. Then making it sound natural, And by natural, I don't mean like the way people really speak. And we get in this argument all the time with actors where it's like, oh, it's not written the way I would say it. And I'm like, well, we can maybe adjust that. It's a new play. But also take a breath, look the other person in the eyes, find the key word that allows that, mm-hmm. that sentence to have meaning. If I say to you, pass me the salt, that means pass me the salt. But if I say pass me the salt, it means don't pass it to Matt.
Right.
Or if I say pass me the salt, it means don't pass me the pepper. You know, like there's a, there's just sort of key things and clues. So I think it's the same amount of preparation.
It must be great, Matt, for you, but also frustrating when you are, you know, available and around and people say, can we mess with this? I mean, how much you have to go in with some flexibility, I guess. This is the first time that this script is being performed. Is that
yes,
correct?
It's had readings and, mm-hmm. and worked on it.
This is the first full production.
This is the first world premiere.
So are you like, how dare you ask me to change this line? Or are you bending over backwards to try and accommodate these first individuals who are going to take your baby and really put it all the way on stage?
I'm pretty accommodating. Am I pretty accommodating?
You are.
I'm pretty accommodating.
Yeah.
Half
of the notes are sent in emails.
That's true. Well, I wish I could have been here the whole time. I live in Chicago, mm-hmm. And I was here for the first week, and that felt fantastic. It was really freeing to be able to be there live and collaborating with everyone on the words that I'd been working on for so long, instead of by myself in my at my desk. And then I was gone for the next 3 weeks of rehearsal, back home and then back in for this week. And those 3 weeks, I trust those guys. And Lee was really good about explaining why we might need to change something and I've always been kind of an easy collaborator. I want to try what other people are thinking because that might be great. I've been wrong enough that I realized that, if I run into something that would fundamentally change the theme or the feeling of the play or what I'm trying to say or a character, then I could put my foot down. But I haven't run into that with this one. We've all been on the same page pretty much the whole time.
I'm pretty loyal to writers anyway, so I put the actors through their paces before I ask for a change. Yeah.
Yeah, make sure something doesn't work mm-hmm. before we change it. It was actually a pretty easy process for me. I wish I could have been there the whole time because I find theater really fun. Making the process of making something, and as a writer, I get to make it from scratch, which is really the cool, which is what has drawn me to that. And it's a little frightening too.
I like the arc, by the way, about Mike's writing career that he's very insecure about, and Deb is super proud of him, and he's like, please just stop talking about it. But you can tell, or at least it felt to me as if, my God, if she did stop believing in him and bragging about him, he would just absolutely fold like a card table.
Yeah, she's propping him up mm-hmm. for sure in that first act. And Mike is not in any way based on me and my wife's relationship.
Not in any way?
Not in any way, Lee. Not at all.
I actually didn't hear that from the director the night that I went to see the show.
No. That's never been a suspicion
didn't.
Of mine.
Wait, what? Oh, you did? You put a little bit of yourself in mm-hmm. everything, and that's kind of an obvious one that he is a writer. I don't think he's the lead of the show or the character that changes the most in the show, but every story comes from a personal place in one way, and that little piece of the story is you never feel like you've done quite enough. You know, when you're in your mid-20s, you have that idea that, oh my God, I need to really quickly discover who I am and make my mark on the world. And then you hit 35 and it's been 10 years and you haven't quite done that. and you start thinking about it a little bit differently, which really started my whole idea about self-esteem and sort of where I get it from. And that's where the theme of the play kind of comes from. Is it how I feel about myself as a whatever I am, a writer or an architect or whatever, or a father or a, husband? Is it how I feel about myself, or is it how I think others feel about me?
Mm-hmm.
Or, Yeah, and what I think is neat about their relationship is that he feels pretty worthless because of this like professional failing, and but he's got a great relationship. He's got an awesome wife that other people envy and want, you know. But at the moment in his life, he is defining himself by his going to getting a creative writing degree and making upwards of $50 on one story that was published
upwards in a of bad $50, magazine. Right.
Mm-hmm. And he's paying student loans for something that he just hasn't, you know, cracked into. But he's sort of ignoring all the other good things that are around him that when the apocalypse hits them, they get to look at things a little differently. I don't want the apocalypse to happen because I don't think I would do as well.
It is going to happen.
No. Post me, please.
The thing about that, though, is, you know, the way we're talking about this, I'm not spoiling anything, I don't think, but everybody comes to, you know, to some realizations about how they've been living their lives after mm-hmm. everything changes. And in some ways, they kind of embrace being freed from all these expectations they had before. And it seems that everybody thinks that, like, you know what, if I could just simplify everything, mm-hmm. but no one in the world is going to do it short of something like an apocalypse, right? Yeah. We can all talk about it around the dinner table and no one,
right.
or very few people actually make good on that.
I don't know. We've had some really interesting conversations about what happens when trauma occurs. There's some spoiler alerts that I won't put in there, but you know that there's two different perspectives, I think, or two different ways of surviving that are like that Matt puts out there in this play. And one is go it alone, survivor mode, take what you need, continue moving, stay moving at all times, you know, food, women, everything is for fuel. And I think the other version is you rely on the strength of your friends, and they're not your enemy anymore. They're the comfort, they're the strength that you draw from. I think that's actually a beautiful part of the play.
We're speaking with director Lee Troll and playwright Matt Lyle about Barbecue Apocalypse, which opens May 23rd and runs through June 21st at Kitchen Dog Theater in Dallas. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, communication, piano, and Portuguese. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. A play called Barbecue Apocalypse opens May 23rd and runs through June 21st at the Kitchen Dog Theater in Dallas. We have its director, Lee Troll, and the playwright, Matt Lyle, with us in studio today. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. This is actually the performance of Barbecue Apocalypse as part of a festival. Is that right?
That is true. It runs the same dates, basically. Mm-hmm. It's a series of world premieres, about half a dozen world premieres. That
you toss that off like it's nothing. It's cool.
It's nothing. Oh, just yeah, no big deal. And it's the artistic directors, Chris Carlos and Tina Parker, plus the artistic company, quite a few of us. I didn't participate as much this year. Close to 300 or 400 scripts. It's an open submission policy from all around the country. And throughout the years, a lot of sort of amazing writers have had their, you know, first plays read here. People that have gone on to be Pulitzer finalists and all of that. And Kitchen Dog is part of a broader network of theaters called the National New Play Network, which, you know, include like Woolly Mammoth in D.C. and the Magic Theater, which premiered all of Sam Shepard's plays in San Francisco. So there's this... It's really interesting. My day job is director of new play development at the Dallas Theater Center, and this was really my first way into learning about that, was acting in the world premieres at Kitchen Dog and then directing the readings and having my own play read at one point. And then this play was read in the festival last year. Is that right?
Yes. Last summer it was it was just a stage reading of like the second draft of the play.
Right. There's usually a main stage show, which is what Barbecue Apocalypse is, which means lights and costumes, and then stage readings, which if you've never attended a stage reading, they're sort of extraordinary. I mean, it's actors with a music stand, and sometimes there's actual staging, and sometimes they just stand at the music stands and they just read the play. It's like a radio hour or something like that, and it can be really powerful. It can be really excruciating for the writer, you know, because it's the first time they're really hearing it out loud. But powerful for the audience, and those are all pay what you can. So you get really fun like groups of people coming to see it,
and then you get to talk to as a player. I came up when they did it last year for Barbecue, and I got to have a great conversation with the audience. It was like 90 people telling me what they thought of my play.
In a way, that's got to be nice because I've been to some discussions after a full production, and then people, although they're interesting things to ask about, people inevitably want to know about like, you know, tricks of lighting or costumes or something that, and it feels like the performers and maybe other people involved really want to talk content, and that's not, and it, maybe with a staged reading, that's all you can talk about.
That's all there is the content. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And with the playwright there, which a lot of the time, they're not always able to come in, but there's some every year.
About half of them have really neat playwright in,
I mean, it was a really focused conversation because I was there. I wanted them to talk to the actors more, but they wanted to know. They wanted to ask me all the questions about the words, which helped me a lot.
I find those conversations very difficult, and I do a lot of them, and because they can grow in really weird ways. I mean, sometimes people can get really fixated on a part of the play that, and it can be, I think, damaging to the play at times because it feels like a sort of passionate discussion by one person about one part of the play can feel, I think, sometimes to the writer like, oh my God, I've really led this person down the wrong path, or I've really done this or whatever else, when that person might actually just brought something into the room.
Right.
So I'm very tough during those when I lead them because I want to make sure I'm asking them questions and guiding that content. Because sometimes for me, if I hear just their opinions, I'm not getting, it gets a little wayward. Instead of going, hey, who did you think was the protagonist of the play? Where did you get confused? I think you find that people start to still lead you surprising places that you can't control, which is good, but at least keeps it more focused. They're difficult conversations, and it can be hard. Some writers won't allow you to do it.
So what is the prognosis for a world premiere? I mean, how does word get around about new plays, and how do they sort of work their way to other companies around the country, and how does that work?
I don't know. I wish I had a better. No, there's a pipeline. There's a lot of plays out there with a lot less people doing them. Though I feel like it is. I feel like it's becoming a little more in vogue to create and to help writers put up new plays in cities. Because if you have that play at your theater that is a hit, and then that's that theater's play then. They premiered August Osage County like Steppenwolf did in Chicago, and then they've got that forever. So I think people are realizing that. But what you do is, from my perspective as the lowly playwright writing by myself and then just sending out pages to people, is I research all the workshop opportunities and contests and theaters that accept submissions, which there are a lot less, or there's lots of stipulations on what they're looking for that kind of weed out a lot of those. And then I just send them off into, I will be back to you in 6 weeks to 6 month land. And then I just kind of try to forget about it. When those calls, when they do call, are pretty rewarding. A lot of plays, though, will go places and then just get nothing but workshops and never get productions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an oversaturated market.
Workshops are cheap.
They're cheap.
Productions
and
are risky.
Yeah, and I think theaters that do world premiere productions are really brave, important, vital theaters in this country because you're really putting your money where your mouth is, you know,
it might not work at all.
Yeah. And it's just like, you know, going from just sort of dating someone to calling them your girlfriend, you know, like life is different from that point on. You're in it together at that point. Whereas before it's sort of like, oh, nice play. We'll read it out loud. And, you know, and I think that has great value and can lead to big things. but also an actual full production is really crucial. The really difficult thing, I think, is actually the second production.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's also an obsession for theaters around the country of like, we world premiered it, and that's kind of the end of what happens.
Hmm.
And I think that that can be really tricky, because what you're looking for is, as a theater sometimes, is that stamp, that
the cachet
to see this new play, because right. It's a world premiere,
right.
As opposed to just a play you never heard of. And I think that cultivating a theater audience for contemporary new work, which I would say is just a play you haven't seen yet in mm-hmm. this market, is can be very difficult.
So how carefully, if you said that for the festival, you know, 300 or 400 works were read. I mean, how do you sit down with everyone and imagine whether it could be produced, or are there tricks for getting through a script and knowing how interested you are and how much energy to give to it?
There are tricks, unfortunately. you know, and this is it can be very difficult to read through a whole script that isn't
good.
Good. Sometimes you can tell very quickly if it's not good. And that is sort of like, on a basic level, you're like, oh, this person has never written anything before, and I don't know why they've chosen to. But often that's not the problem. Often the problem, if there's a problem, is that you know the theater you're reading for.
Mm.
And you know you have to get through a whole bunch of them. So if you get 10 or 15 pages in and you're like, yeah, it's lovely, but it has nothing to do with the type of work Kitchen Nook Theater does, or the Dallas Theater Center does, or Steppenwolf does, whoever you're reading for at that time, then you kind of have to skip ahead. Check out, see if an alien baby is born at the end of it or something, you know, like, you know, right. And be like, oh, I didn't see that coming. Let's go back and read. But the really, really great ones, the ones that are on, the ones that are just like perfect for your company and whatever else, you get about 10 pages in and you just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes actually I get about 10 pages in and I think, that's good. I'm going to put it over here so I'll actually read it. But
when I get to that moment where I'm reading
clearly. Yeah, which is, it feels... I don't do this at my job because I get a lot less submissions at the Dallas Theater Center because we have a tougher submission policy, so I read everything. But for Kitchen Dog, at times, it can feel like it can get very, very difficult. And you don't want to brutalize, you know, like the piece either. If it's actually a lovely piece, then you start thinking about a place that might like it
mm-hmm.
and about, you know, where you could send it and who might want to read it.
Yeah.
And you just don't have enough time.
And I guess, Matt, you could make yourself crazy thinking about all of the different parameters that different theaters have and different festivals and what they might want. I mean, you have to be aware of it, but at some point, right, you have to shut that out and be true to your idea.
Yeah, just go for it. I've written a lot of other plays that I really like and I think have worked really well in front of the audiences that have seen them, but they're just not right for 95% of theaters, mm-hmm. like something that it just wouldn't work at the Dallas Theater Center because it's just not even close to the type of work that they do, you know, something that's really peculiar. But with this one, the Barbecue Apocalypse, I felt pretty confident sending it to whoever because it's kind of a straightforward contemporary play that's like plays that you see, but unique on its own. Not kind of gimmicky or like I've done that before.
Right. No, you're full of gimmicks, and I think that it's really helpful that you've broken out of that.
Thank
and,
you.
And hopefully this will be a new, you know, shining part of your
yep.
career.
I've matured.
Yeah. There's darkness in your past, I mm-hmm. think. Yeah.
You do, though, in this, in both the script and in the directing, you have to find the balance between what is like totally implausible and mm-hmm. what feels very real.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that the balancing act is challenging. Maybe for you both it was easy. It comes across like it was easy, but...
It was easy to read. I understood it from the minute I read it.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I put it up on its feet, I think I led the actors astray very early with thoughts of sort of style or comedy bits. It took us a while to start learning about who the real people are and what they're really saying, what they're really doing. Because it can be as dangerous in a, you know, to stop and be like, well, this is the comedy part. And now this is the dramatic part. And I've always sort of hated hearing that sound, the sound of comedy and then the sound of
and
drama.
Cha-ching. Yeah.
And I always feel like, I'm like, who's that person who like a little while ago was talking like this and now they're getting real, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, but those are two different voices. I think that And that's what I think I was pushing everybody into early. And then I was like, wait a minute, I don't like that.
But as a director, it's hard because, like, on day one, everyone looks to you like, okay, Lee's got this thing figured out, right?
Right. And I thought I did on day one. Mm-hmm. So I was very confident on day one. I mean, I was truly like, this is how this is going to go down.
How different was it?
What do you mean? Like, from day one till now?
Well, you said, like, in terms of style or the way that you thought you would have everybody treat the material.
I think it is very different to me. I feel like the actors are being asked to do very, very real acting, the kind of acting they would do in a dramatic play, with this sort of ridiculous stuff going on. Like, mm-hmm. And even since you've seen it, we've gone even further with that. And I'm discovering that the darker parts of the script, because Matt is not a very dark guy, and so it's what part of the fun is that it's sort of he has darkness in him, sure, but as far as, like, you know, the darkness is often one of the punchlines of the show, as, mm-hmm. as opposed to. But what we found is jokes about suicide work better if the guy looks like he's about to commit suicide. The punchline's funnier, you know, and, you know, monologues about darkness, you know, and the darkness that's creeping in, if the person doing that monologue is really invested in that and really means it, then the joke that's waiting just on the other side of it lands even more.
Mm-hmm.
I think about movies like Tootsie or that great, I think it's called The End of the World, the great Seth Rogen movie this summer about, you know, the...
Don't mention other apocalyptic comedies that perhaps made millions and millions of dollars.
Or
It's not a crowded field, you know. But apocalyptic comedies are not a crowded field.
Oh, that's
field.
True.
But
that's
I think that those actors are all very, very committed to what's happening on screen, and mm-hmm. that and the rhythm, like we talked about before, is underneath it, so it keeps the pace going.
Mm-hmm.
So tomorrow night is the official opening night.
Yes, God help us.
Yes.
Is it upsetting to think that, okay, then it's locked, right? You can't change the script, or can you? Is that something that's still open to do after opening night?
Not for this show, not for the run of this, but you can definitely write all you want.
In the life of the play, yes. Mm-hmm. The audience that I see and that we get feedback about will inform things future. So yeah, it's the script itself is not locked. I will keep working on it. As far as, like, for the sake of the actors and the technicians and stuff, once we're open, we're doing the play that's out there.
Yeah. That means we can work all the way up until tomorrow.
Yeah.
All the way up until, like, the lights go up. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and we 7:58.
Nobody's sleeping.
I'll rewrite
until then.
Something. Right. Yes.
Matt Lyle is a playwright whose newest work, Barbecue Apocalypse, runs May 23rd through June 21st at Kitchen Dog Theater in Dallas, the same time that they are having an ongoing theater festival with staged readings and other productions. Lee Troll is director of Barbecue Apocalypse. It's been delightful to have you both here. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
It has been delightful.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.